the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. This week, our guest is Kim Fischera, who's a CPA. He'll be discussing tax strategies and avoiding tax traps. Today's topic, a very timely one, you might imagine. Everybody's favorite subject. Wait for it. Drum roll. Taxes. Deadline April 15th for people here in the United States. So today's subject will be a discussion about how to reduce that annual tax bill. Under President Obama's administration, we have seen the highest tax rate in decades. So government is taking more of what you own and taking more of what you invest. So strategies to reduce taxes, put more money into your pocket, more money you can save, and the closer you can get to your retirement goals.
And it's not just that, John. I mean, we talk about retirement planning on the show. And of course, getting to retirement, that means putting money aside. You're saving for the future. Well, the more that you can save, the more money that you have, discretionary income or income that's left over, the more that you save, the sooner you're going to reach your retirement goal or the better off you're going to be in retirement. So a key part of retirement planning is also tax planning. Because the nature of our tax system, it's a very progressive tax system. The more you make, the more you pay, and the higher rate at which you are taxed. And it's become more progressive under President Obama. And there's also a whole new set of stealth taxes that have come into play as a result of Obamacare, which we're going to get into the program today, that are catching a lot of middle-class taxpayers. And we're going to talk about some of the key tax strategies of how to reduce that or get caught up in a tax trap. We've had a lot of emails, and we also get often questions on this program. And also, I've just seen it with individuals who have come into our office, and I go, I can't believe what happened to me in 2014. Now, 2014 was your 2013 income tax return, and that's when the full effect of Obamacare taxes went into effect. They were to go into after the presidential election, which was 2013. And that was the big surprise to a lot of individuals when they paid their taxes, which was April 15th of last year. So anyway, we're going to be talking about that on today's program.
We will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor, period. If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan, period.
Well, that's the very familiar voice of President Obama telling us what was actually in the tax bill. At least that's what they said they were working on. When you realize that almost all of the promises, he said, this is a promise and period, this is the way it would be. It's turned out for a lot of Americans that wasn't the way it was. And remember that Obamacare was to tax only the rich. We kept hearing that the rich should pay a little more of their fair share. I can never figure out how you pay more of your fair share, Jim. Once you figure out what's fair, that's it. If you pay more, it would seem like it's not fair, but that's okay. That's the double talk coming out of Washington. Also, like the false premise about keeping your doctor, that your insurance plan wouldn't go up or wouldn't cost more, or you could keep your plan. Well, all of those things have fallen through. And it turns out that this tax, rather than taxing the rich, you know where it has to go. It hit a lot of the middle class taxpayers, and these taxes went into effect after the presidential election. There was a reason for that. It might have affected the election, and we wouldn't want that. So you don't want people to know what it is you're really going to do with them. So for the first time, taxpayers discovered all of this when they paid their taxes for 2013 in 2014. And so tax planning became even more critical. So what we're going to do is begin with an update on tax brackets and also let listeners know about stealth taxes that came into existence under Obamacare.
It's going to be very, very exciting. But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it away from the fog of the controversy.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, former Speaker Pelosi. You have to understand that Congress is telling you you won't find out what is in the bill until you pass it. As a matter of fact, a lot of our people in Congress actually had to pass the bill without themselves knowing what was in it. It was so complex and rushed through Congress in such a way. But one thing Speaker Pelosi was correct about, it was going to be very, very exciting. Yes, indeed. A lot of people's adrenaline has now gotten running now that they've discovered what's in the bill? Much higher taxes for the middle class.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that probably everybody is familiar with. At least this is the way it was sold. Now, originally, the bill was going to go into effect. We were going back to the Clinton tax rates of 39.6 from the 35. And that was to hit couples at 450,000 and individuals at 400. Now, these tax brackets are adjusted every single year for inflation. So, for this year, for a single individual, it's $413,200 you hit and bump into that 39.6% bracket. If you're married, it's $464,850. Now, there's more to these brackets because this was what we were told. Hey, it's only people making $400 if you're single, $450. Well, there's more to it than that. There's three other brackets that affect you. And some of them can be substantial. The next bracket is $200,000 if you're single, $250,000 if you're married. Now, if you exceed those levels, you get hit with an additional 0.9% extra Medicare tax. Now, you're already paying Medicare tax when you exceed your Social Security limit. I think it's like $118,000. So anything over $118,000, you pay Medicare tax. But if you're single making over $200,000, married making over $250,000, you get an additional 0.9% extra Medicare tax. So that is key. Then we have another bracket. The next bracket level is $258,250 if you're single and $309,900 if you're married. These are real key because you start to lose your itemized deductions. And we're going to get into that in some detail here, because once you exceed that, we'll talk about this when we get to tax planning strategies. They take 3% of your adjusted gross income. Let's just make this easy. And just say you made $300,000. They take 3% of $300,000. That's $9,000. They would subtract that $9,000 from your itemized deduction. So they're really, this was called the Pease Amendment, and it's really losing part of your itemized deductions. Now, there's an additional bracket. If you are single, making $200,000, or if you're married, $250,000, then your capital gains rate goes from 15% to 20%. In addition to that, they slap on a 3.8% surtax, so your capital gains and dividend and investment income tax is 23.8% on capital gains, and it's 23.8% on dividends. Now, if it's interest income, you pay whatever your marginal tax bracket. Now, this 3.8% surtax applies to rents. It applies to income from annuities and interest income from bonds, with the exception of tax-free bonds. So, once again, we have three different tax brackets that apply to different things. We have the original 400, 450 bracket, which is now 413, 465 close to. That's when you jump into the 39.6% bracket. At the 200, 250, you pay an additional 9% Medicare tax. At the 309 and the 258, you start losing your itemized deductions. And at 200 and 250, you jump into the higher capital gains tax rate and the Obamacare surtax of 3.8%.
All right, so the tax rates are much higher than we had been told or promised. And when you add in all of these tax rates, what is the effective tax rate? It's obvious that the tax rates are higher with extra taxes on investments. There are extra taxes which result in a loss of deductions and exemptions. There's an extra Medicare tax. So what's the number? If we really tried to grind this out into a number, Jim, the big problem that people have in trying to figure out what they're really paying in taxes, it's like a shell game when you're filling out your return, or if you're examining it, if you have a CPA do it or something like that. How do you know what you're really paying in taxes? Because over here it's added, but then it's reduced over here, but then there's an add-on over here, and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. You can't follow this.
No, it's very complex. I'm going through a six-month tax course that I'm taking right now. It is. It's more convoluted. There's more deductions. There's phase-outs. There's all kinds of things. And so that's why it's getting more difficult to file your taxes. But it's a number that you have to really understand if you're planning for retirement. So let's start with what this all adds up to. All right. When you exceed that 413 and 464, you go from a 35% tax rate to 39.6. So 39.6 is the tax rate that you have, that's the highest income tax. But the combined Medicare tax is 2.35%. And the Pease Amendment, where they phase out, they take 3% of your adjusted gross income and then subtract that from your itemized deductions, that's the equivalent of 1.05. So, John, the total effective tax rate is now 43%, the highest tax rate that they have been prior to Ronald Reagan. So this is a key figure for investment planning because it basically tells you what that next dollar of earnings is going to be taxed at. Say, for example, you got a job promotion or you got a cost of living increase. And let's say you got a cost of living increase and you're making an extra $1,000 a year. If your marginal tax bracket is 43% with all this, you're going to pay 43% of that next $1,000 in taxes. Likewise, when you take a look at investments, we're not even talking about what they did to investment income, which can hit a lot of couples that have real estate income, interest income from bonds or CDs, and have annuities that they're getting annuity payments. There's a 3.8% surtax on that income. But John, the effective tax rate is now 43% if your income exceeds a certain level.
Okay, now that's at the federal level. Now the figure becomes more substantial when state taxes are added into the mix. And depending on your state and how much they take as a percentage of the federal is usually what they do, the total marginal tax rate can be as high as 56%, over half of your income. That is quite a staggering take.
Yeah, that was why we heard Phil Mickelson, who made that comment. He goes, you know, maybe I don't play golf anymore because Phil was in that 56, 57% being a resident of California. Maybe Phil moves and that would get rid of 13.3%. But one of the key elements that's very important when you're saving for retirement is reducing the government's tax take. I mean, there are loopholes and there's strategies. They're put in there for a reason. They're put in there to reward special interest groups. Hollywood has special deductions. The energy industry has special deductions and exemptions. There's all kinds of things because how do Congress people reward the people that contribute to their campaign? Hence our convoluted tax system. But anyway, they're put in there for a reason, and you owe it to yourself to take advantage of them because otherwise you're throwing money away, paying extra taxes. The more you pay in taxes, the less you have to save, the less money you're going to have when you retire.
All right, so now we know what the effective real tax rates are, so you have a real-world number that lets you plan. Let's move on to the strategies that you can use to legitimately reduce taxes. This time, we want to think about it. We have 9 months to plan again, so let's try to reduce our 2015 tax payments.
You know, the key of tax strategy under the Obama tax regime is really reducing your taxable income on the front page of your tax return. And the reason for that is that so many of Obamacare stealth taxes kick into gear off the front page of your tax return. A good example is the reduction of your itemized deductions. And this is an easy one to do if you are in one of those brackets I just talked about, whether it's the phase out of exemptions. Gosh, we forgot to talk about that one. The phase out of losing some of your itemized deductions or paying extra taxes on your investment income. You need to know that figure because the bottom number on the front page of your tax return is something we call adjusted gross income. Once you reach those figures, if you're married, $309,900, so look at that bottom figure on the front page of your return, or $258,250 if you're single, they're going to take 3% of that number and reduce your itemized deductions, which are on the back side of that tax return. So the first strategy really is to reduce your adjusted gross income to keep you out of those Obama tax brackets.
Okay, well, that sounds like simple theory, but how do you do that? I mean, are there a lot of options out there to do that? Maybe you should contrast between what employees versus self-employed people can do.
You know, what goes on here, it's a technical term that we use in the business, and that's what we call basically deductions above the line. And that's really the first page of your tax return. So if you look at that front page of your tax return, remember the bottom line figure is called adjusted gross income. Anything from the very top line to the bottom of that page, that's what we're talking about above the line. It's the most effective way to reduce your tax return. A lot of people concentrate on itemized deductions that they're phasing out of. We'll get to that in just a moment. But you really want to concentrate on the above line tax deductions, because that is really going to be the most effective in terms of reducing your overall tax bill. And so the common thing is that's where all these stealth taxes come in, with the phase out of your exemptions, the loss of part of your itemized deductions, the extra Medicare tax, the extra surtax on your income, the higher capital gains taxes. All of those things are going to be built off that front page of your tax return. And this is where your strategy, the most effective strategies, need to be concentrated.
Well, what kind of deductions are available for, let's say, for example, for employees? They have fewer options because in business, there are ways to work in various factors.
When you take a look at the front page of the tax return, the kind of things that can reduce that are, for example, trade or business expenses not incurred as an employee. As an employee, I'm sorry, you don't get that. You have to be self-employed. Expenses, for example, producing rents or royalties, losses from the sale or exchange from property, contributions to self-employed retirement plans like SEP IRAs, or contributions to, let's say, an IRA if you're eligible. If you're divorced and you're paying alimony, alimony is a deduction. Interest penalty, for example, on early withdrawal from, like, let's say, a CD account. Moving expenses, contributions to the Archer Medical Savings Account, or MSAs. Interest paid on qualified education loans. There's a limit on that, of course. And then qualified higher education expenses with limits. And then something that we know is contributions to health savings accounts. All of these are on the front page of your tax return. And this is probably one of the most effective ways that you can reduce your tax return, is taking advantage of those. And, you know, for most individuals, John, that are employees working for a company, you know, the thing that comes to mind is, you know, your 401k program, your 403b if you're a teacher, educator, or 457 plan if you work for the government. Those are some of the common things that you can take. Or if you have investment property, the expenses involved with that, let's say you have to move to another state to get a job, those are things that you might have. Or, for example, a health savings account is another way that you can reduce your adjusted gross income.
All right. Well, those are the obvious ones: pensions, 401k, IRA, SEP IRAs. These are the obvious ones. Now, some of the more interesting ones.
You know, the next strategy is to reduce the tax on your investment income, both at the federal and the state level. Now, investors need to understand that interest income is taxed at your highest marginal tax rate. That 43% that I talked about, which is the highest marginal tax rate, that's what your investment income is taxed at. Now, dividends are more tax favored. They can be either 15 or 20%, depending on where your income falls, and then also maybe 23.8% or 18.8%, depending if you get hit with the stealth Obama taxes. And what you want to do is minimize interest income, because it's always going to be taxed at your highest marginal tax rate. The exception is probably things like tax-free bonds. So if you are investing for retirement, you want to use four strategies. You want to use tax-favored investments, such as, let's say, dividends from stocks, because they're taxed at a lower tax rate, either 15 or 20 or 18.8 or 23.8, depending on where you fall with the Obama stealth tax. The other way is looking at tax-free bonds, especially if you're over the 30% tax bracket at the federal level, not to mention what state bracket that you're in. And also, you know, you might want to consider something like a tax-deferred variable annuity if you're investing in mutual funds in your high tax bracket. You know, what you don't want to do, as many mutual funds do, is at the end of the year, if they've taken any capital gains, short-term or long-term, they distribute those and they declare them at the end of the year. And you're thinking, oh, I just got all these capital gains I didn't think I was going to have. So you might want to do that inside a variable annuity. And then you have things like tax-sheltered investments. These are like master limited partnerships, real estate investment trust, or real estate rental property, because you can shelter a lot of the expenses with depreciation, interest expense, and things like that. So you want to use those four strategies. You do not want taxable investment interest. It is just taxed at your highest tax bracket, not to mention you're getting paid peanuts or zero for investing in interest-related investments. All of this reduces your adjusted gross income. And I mean, that's how you got guys like George Soros and Warren Buffett. I mean, most of their income is taxed because of dividends and capital gains. So they're in that 20% tax bracket. Well, you owe it to yourself. You can do that too.
Most investors, though, aren't doing this, Jim. I mean, most of them are in bond funds, which are taxed at a much higher rate, unless, of course, they're tax-free bonds.
Yeah, I would say once you're over a 30% tax bracket, federal, state, combination thereof, you shouldn't be in taxable investments like taxable bonds, because they're going to take a third or 40%, or, you know, depending on your bracket, they could take up to 56% of your investment income. So, you know, that's quite a bit of a tax bite. You know, and some of these bond funds, the yield after taxes isn't even keeping you up with inflation. And so you really want to focus here a couple things. You really want to know what your marginal tax bracket is, and you need to know what those four Obama stealth tax brackets are, because you're going to get hit with the Medicare tax. You're going to get hit with the itemized deductions, phasing out of your exemptions, the higher capital gains tax, the higher investment taxes. So there's four brackets you need to be aware of. And then once you're aware of that number, then you can start using strategies to start reducing that number, because otherwise you're going to be just cutting big checks to the government for the rest of your working career.
Okay, so if that reduces the federal tax, now what about the state tax side of things? Is there anything different? Does it just uniformly drop things, or are there some special things you can do in your own state? In states like California, Hawaii, New York, those are pretty high tax states. Others don't have income tax, so it depends.
There's a couple things you can do to reduce state taxes. The one obvious one would be municipal bonds. And especially if you have a state that has income taxes, you'd want to own municipal bonds in that state that you live in. But if you are a high net worth individual, there's a new kind of trust. It's called a non-grantor trust, that we call them DINGs, NINGs, and WING trusts. And that's based on really the states that they're domiciled. The DING is from Delaware. The NING is from Nevada, and the WING is from Wyoming. And what it is, it's the income of the trust, if established in those states, even by investors who live elsewhere. And, you know, I don't have a lot of time to get into a lot of the details here, but we're using these with our very higher end net worth, especially California residents. But it's going to be a great way to avoid paying state taxes on your investment income. And in states like California, that tax rate can get as high as 13.3%. Just about everybody is in a 9.3% tax bracket in the state of California. So it's something that we're starting to use that is an effective way, because, you know, John, you know, you see this all the time where you get these movie stars or, you know, athletes, and, you know, what do? When they sign their contract, the first thing they do is they move out of a high tax state to a low tax state or a no tax state.
Well, Jim, I never heard of this kind of a trust before. Is it legit? I mean, if you take something like this, are you going to get clobbered with an audit? Can it stand up?
No, they are legitimate. In fact, you can get an IRS ruling letter on this. Now, the IRS is obviously going to charge you a fee. There's nothing free from government. But, John, I don't want to give the impression that everybody ought to be using this. This is only worthwhile for individuals that are in very high tax bracket states like Hawaii, California, New York, and individuals that have a high net worth. It's a way to reduce the state income taxes on your investment income. And it really works for somebody not only retired or somebody that has, let's say, a flexible schedule. Because another thing that works very well is something that we call the tax inversion. And that's basically plain and simple. It's moving from a high tax state to either a low tax state or a no tax state. You know, as I mentioned, you see this all the time. One of the first things that Tiger Woods did when he turned pro was move from California to Florida, because Florida doesn't have an income tax. That's why you see a lot of professional athletes, golfers, baseball players, football players living there, and you see a lot of movie stars, because They don't want to pay 13.3% to the state of California. They may have their summer homes here in Malibu and on the beach to get out of the heat and the humidity during the summer. But their main residence is in the state of Florida, where they're not paying income tax. And that is something that we're using more and more with retired couples in high tax state or tax inversions. Because when you're paying 9, 10, or 13 in California, 11 in the state of Hawaii, that can be a considerable amount of income, depending on, you know, how much income that you have.
So effectively reducing your adjusted gross income through pensions, reducing taxable investment income. Now, you mentioned about deduction phase out. What about itemized deductions? You know, you hear this talk that government would like to get rid of them altogether, probably under the guise of a tax reform. Always be aware of the word tax reform, because you can bet your bottom dollar that they are going to bring in another tax somewhere else, which will scoop it. Yeah, hold on to your wallet. As a matter of fact, whenever you hear talk about a national sales tax, and if they ever get to this, Jim, I'm going to promise you, they're going to say, well, we'll bring in a national sales tax, but we'll radically reduce the income tax. And then they'll do that. And 24 months later, the income tax will be right up where it was before. And now you'll have a sales tax on top of that. That's the way it's going to go.
Well, we saw that with President Reagan. We were using a lot of tax shelters. I call them the good old days. I can remember in December figuring out what my taxes were, and I bought a tax shelter and I zeroed out my taxes. Those days are gone. Reagan came in with the 86 tax reform bill, and he said, look, we're going to get rid of all this kind of nonsensical, non-productive tax shelter stuff. In exchange for that, we're going to reduce the tax rates from 50% down to 28%. Now, we'll get rid of all the tax deductions the way you got it passed. All the tax shelters and things like that were done away with in the first year of the bill. And the lower tax rate would be phased in over a three-year period, which they did. Reagan leaves office. George Bush Sr. comes in, raises tax rates to 31% from 28%. And then, of course, Bill Clinton came in following Bush and raised them to 39.6. And you're right, John, that's exactly what they're doing. And that's why they're talking about tax reform, maybe using a sales tax or a VAT tax in exchange for lowering tax rates. But you can bet your bottom dollar, as soon as they lower them, they'll be raising them, because they're always looking for ways to fleece the taxpayer and get more revenues. Washington has this insatiable appetite for spending. Spending buys votes. And it's how they pay back special interest.
And maybe Ronald Reagan said it best.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. It is time to reawaken this industrial giant, to get government back within its means, and to lighten our punitive tax burden. And these will be our first priorities, and on these principles, there will be no compromise.
You know what? It doesn't seem like we've done that yet, Jim, though.
Well, you know, no, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Okay. Reagan came in. The tax rate was 70%. He brought them all the way down to 28% when he left office. He raised the exemption on estates. He got rid of taxation of estates on the death of the first spouse. He raised the exemption from $175,000 to $600,000, brought the estate tax rates down. He did all of those things, John, but they got reversed in the following decade. So, you know, I'm going to give the guy credit.
Well, that's why there's a move on now to simply junk the IRS code. They say you can't reform it because everybody will be in there trying to tug and pull on the levers and get their interest in there in this so-called reform. They said the only thing you can do is haul it over to the shredder and throw it in. And you do this by saying on such and such a date, January 1st, 2020, there will be no more income tax. And that gives the financial industry time to plan, financial planners, and everybody knows what they're moving toward. It's not like you do it tomorrow, but you say you're going to do it. But unless you keep them away of keeping their hands and getting in there and pulling the levers, that's not going to happen. I mean, it's just not a realistic dream. So, Jim, now let's look at those itemized deductions. They would love to get rid of the home mortgage deduction. Remember, we used to be able to deduct any interest, any of your credit accounts and everything. That all went away. And the mortgage deduction, boy, that's a big one right there.
Yeah, you used to deduct consumer interest, you know, sales tax, personal interest. Right now, the way the law is, you can deduct interest on a home, your residence, up to $1 million. If you have a mortgage beyond $1 million, anything over $1 million is prorated and non-deductible. There's also an additional $100,000 on top of the $1 million that can be used for either a home equity loan, second home. And then other types of itemized deductions are things like casualty losses if they exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income. Once again, going back to that adjusted gross income and top line deductions. That's why it is really, folks, when we talk about tax planning today, we talk about tax planning above the line. Miscellaneous itemized deductions, charitable contributions, those are the kind of things that we would include on the backside of your itemized deductions. And once again, the real key here, because a lot of these items, the miscellaneous deductions, you can only deduct the amount that exceeds 2% of your adjusted gross income, property casualty losses up to 10% of your adjusted gross income, medical expenses close to 10% of your adjusted gross income. So really what you want to do with your tax planning is reduce your adjusted gross income, the bottom figure on the front page of that tax return. You need to know what that number is.
Well, as you say, Jim, the focus should really be on the front page of the tax return where you have pensions. Medical savings accounts are really important. In our state, in Idaho, we just upped it from $4,000 to $20,000, 20 or 21.
20?
Yes, you can make a substantial chop out of your income simply by putting that into a medical savings account. I always thought four was low because, you know, you can spend a lot more than that. You can add into that, pay out of that your insurance and everything else.
One trip to the hospital, you go through that very quickly.
Well, exactly. You can wipe out a huge part of your state income tax here in Idaho. Now, not every state's like that, but that's one of those upfront issues. So those are the things that you really have to focus on for the returns. And as we always do here on the program, let us take a case study that usually has a drum roll in there. The cases are real. We changed the names to protect the privacy of the people involved. Right now, we'll call them, let me guess, Paul and what's a good word?
Paul and Kathy Tyler.
Okay. So here we go.
The case that we're going to talk about today, this is Paul and Kathy Tyler. Paul was 43, Kathy was 36, and Paul was a high executive with the healthcare industry provider, and Kathy was a nurse practitioner. And late marriage for both of them. Kathy was pregnant with their first child. Both were very, very successful. They saved a lot. Both of them inherited assets from both their parents. But here was the problem. Their federal tax bracket was 33%, and their state of California tax bracket, which is just about anybody. I mean, if you breathe and have a job, you're probably in the 9.3% bracket in California. So their effective tax rate was 42.3, which was a combination of federal and state. Now, here was the big problem for both of them. Paul's income could exceed over $200,000 depending on the size of the bonus that he got at the end of the year. Now, Kathy's salary was fairly consistent. It was about $95,000. So we already had a problem at close to $300,000. You were running up against those various Obamacare stealth tax brackets. So on top of their salaries, they had four rental properties. They had just enough leverage in it to make it worthwhile. So most of the rents, they were positive cash flow. They were sheltered from the deductions of real estate, which was very great on their part because they realized the tax advantages of owning real estate, and they were smart enough and had enough cash and earning power to be buying real estate with Paul's bonus during the period when real estate prices were really cheap after the financial crisis. So the real key here in the Tyler's case is we wanted to avoid some of the stealth taxes that would creep in. And this is real key to them. At $250,000 of adjusted gross income, they were going to get hit with 3.8% investment tax. That would be on their rental real estate, and it would have been on their investment income. At $250,000, this is probably applies more to Paul than it did Kathy. Paul would get hit, actually both of them, with the 0.9% Medicare tax. And at $300,000, they were going to lose 3% of their adjusted gross income in the form of loss of itemized deductions. So the real key here was they were already using real estate to shelter their income. Their real estate was basically non-taxable for the most part, but they could get hit, depending on how large Paul's bonus was, they could get hit with that 3.8% tax. So the properties were along the coast. They were not highly leveraged. They were positive cash flow. Most of the income was sheltered. So the real issue was their salary. Now, Kathy's salary, that was pretty straightforward, $95,000 a year. She was already putting as much as she could in her 401k program, which was good. Now, the real advantage here and the real tax planning came in here with Paul, because Paul had a number of benefits. Number one, he had a 401k plan at work. He had a stock option plan, and he also had a deferred compensation plan with some partial matching contributions. So the obvious thing was for him to maximize his 401k, which in 2015 is 18,000. When they came to us last year, I think it was 17,500. It went up $500 this year. But here was the thing. They were using the bonus to buy real estate. And I mean, literally, they were getting whacked in terms of his bonus. You know, the government and the state of California were taking literally 40% of his bonus, which, you know, you get a $50,000 bonus, 20 grand right out the door goes to the governor in Washington. So Paul had a deferred compensation program with some partial matching contributions, and they really didn't need it. And they were still saving money. So what we recommended is that he take advantage of his deferred compensation program, because that was money that came right off the top, and that was going to push him down below those stealth Obamacare brackets. And that's really the key, because you want to reduce your adjusted gross income. And that's what we did here. Unfortunately, when he came to us, he already made the election and took the bonus, of which they're going to apply, and they're looking for another piece of real estate. But for 2015, this year, the election is going to be made to use the deferred compensation program, so that, you know, you get a $50,000-$60,000 bonus. That's considerable. And if you can shelter that, that's going to keep them below a lot of those key brackets. So we were using a combination here of 401k, both for Paul, 401k, both for his wife, Kathy. And then the plan for 2015 was to use the deferred comp program, because, you know, if you can take $50,000 and not pay $20,000 up front, that's $20,000 that's working for you. Think about that over a 10-year period of time. That's $200,000 in tax savings that's going to apply to your net worth. So the idea here is we put the entire bonus into the tax deferred program. That was the plan for 2015. That would keep them below $250,000, where all those stealth Obamacare taxes started to come into play as a married couple. And that was the real key here, was using tax deferral in the form of pension plans and deferred compensation to reduce that adjusted gross income figure and keep them below those stealth taxes. And that was the main strategy here, along with tax-sheltered real estate to keep their investment income down.
Well, another success story as far as tax planning. Coming up next, Kim Fischera, CPA, tax strategies, and avoiding tax traps as lifetime income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Puflava or his lifetime income specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, we're not quite done with tax season, but it's probably too late to do much of anything for 2014 taxes, unless maybe you're contributing to a pension plan, SEP, or IRA. But what we're going to do is we're going to talk about avoiding tax traps and tax strategies, because remember, we still have roughly about 9 months left in the year that you can take some effective action to help reduce this year's taxes. In order to help us, I've invited a good friend and tax advisor and CPA, Kim Fischera, to join me on the program. Kim, let's begin with some of the things that changed with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, because everybody's aware of, like, if you're single making $400,000, you're married $450,000, you go into the higher tax brackets. But they also may not be aware of how itemized deductions and exemptions are phased out, or when the Obamacare tax kicks in, and the extra Medicare tax, which can kick in at a lower level of income. So let's begin with the tax rates and go down from there in terms of all the different innuendos and all the little permutations of this tax law, because it's not just a simple income tax based on income of $400 or $450.
Well, it really depends on what you're earning. For those folks that are earning less than $200,000, $250,000, they're still going to enjoy the benefits of the old Bush rates. But for folks who are making higher levels of income, their taxes have been raised. and in a lot of insidious ways. Like you said, it's not straightforward. I can go through some of these factors for you, but the first one is, you know, for a single person making over $400,000 taxable income, married, $450,000 taxable income, they're now subject to the higher tax rate of 39.6%, which used to be 35%. For those folks in that income level, they're also going to be paying higher rates on their capital gains and qualified dividends, which historically have been taxed at a limit of 15%. Now they're up to 20%. For somebody making over adjusted gross income of $300,000 single, they're going to have itemized deductions starting to phase out. So what's insidious about this whole change is that for people making more money, they're not only in a higher tax bracket, but they're losing some of their deductions through the effect of itemized deductions going down, exemption credits phasing out. So not only are you paying higher taxes, but you're losing some of the deductions that you had previously.
Hey, Kim, let me stop you there because this is really insidious, because what they do, as I understand, this goes along with the Pease Amendment. Correct me if I'm wrong. They take 3% of your gross income, and whatever that figure is, they subtract it from your itemized deduction. So you can lose a substantial amount of your deductions.
Yeah, you can lose a proportion of your deductions. It doesn't affect certain things like, I think, medical expenses. There's a few other items that are not affected by it. But overall, it'll bring down your itemized deductions. And, you know, this tax season, I sat with a number of my higher earning clients and just showed them a comparison of 2012 to 2013 and started pointing out, you know, here's your itemized deductions for 2012 and here's what they are for 2013. Nothing changed, but you just lost $6,000 of those or whatever the percentage was. And the same with the exemption. If you make a lot of money and you have a lot of kids and you normally get a lot of exemption deductions, those can be phased out as a result of these changes.
What about also for self-employed individuals, there's also a phase out or a limitation of business deductions. Talk about that, because that is also hitting a lot of self-employed individuals.
Well, for the self-employed individual, first of all, we should probably talk about this 0.9% tax on earned income. For people that, whether they're wage earners or self-employed, once their adjusted gross income gets over a certain level, they're now paying an additional Medicare tax of 0.9% on that. And for those folks that are generating investment income up in these levels, they're going to pay a 3.8% tax on that. But as far as phasing out deductions, you know, for self-employed people, there's not so much of a phase out there versus the employee who has employee business expenses. I'd say the most difficult client to find ways to save taxes with is going to be a high income earner, W-2'd individual who's not self-employed, who doesn't have his own business, but has a lot of unreimbursed business expenses. And there are, for folks that are salesmen or life insurance people that are required to pay for their own expenses that don't get reimbursed from their employers, those folks are going to find that there's a severe limitation on the amount of deductions they can get against income, because for somebody who's employed, they need to deduct those deductions as miscellaneous itemized deduction, which gets phased out. There's a number of phase outs, not only the Pease phase outs overall, but there's also a 2% of adjusted gross income phase out. And then if you have too much of that that's allowed, those deductions aren't deducted for alternative minimum tax. So for people that are employed that have unreimbursed business expenses, they really have a severe limitation on how much tax benefit they can get from those.
So if you look at what the tax increases included, it's not just the fact that, let's say, your income tax bracket went up by 5 percentage points. Your Medicare tax went up by almost 1 percentage point. You have a phase out of your itemized deductions and a phase out of your exemptions. So it's higher Medicare taxes, higher income taxes, loss of deductions, and loss of exemptions. You do a lot of tax returns. Did that surprise quite a bit of your clients? Because the number that the media always went with, well, if you're 400,000 and below and you're single, you don't need to worry. Or if you're 450 or below married, you don't need to worry. But they never told you about the loss of itemized deductions, the additional Medicare tax, and the phase out of exemptions. Because, you know, for a lot of people, as you mentioned, if you're working as an employee for a corporation, about the only thing you have to write off are your exemptions and your itemized deductions.
Yeah, if people were freaked out, the higher income earners were not aware of it. I mean, some were. If people came in earlier and we did tax planning, they were aware of it. But a lot of people, not everybody does tax planning. And if they're making, you know, $800,000 and W-2 employee, and nothing really changed from 2012 to 2013, and they look at the change in their tax rates, they were shocked. And I had to sit and kind of explain all these little insidious changes. I mean, they knew about the higher rates, but they didn't understand the tax on net investment income or on earned income, these additional Medicare taxes. They didn't understand the itemized deduction phase-out and the exemption phase-out. So those are the things I pretty much had to illustrate and educate them on. And so there's an element of frustration there because a lot of those folks, especially, again, the W-2 person, the only line of defense they have is to really use 401k plans, 403b plans, do something through their employer, deferred comp. If you can handle it at that level, that's, you know, one of the only things you can work with.
Well, I know if this continues and more people start to feel this pinch, I think there's going to be pressure with employers to do something for employees. I mean, most of your W-2 or let's say people that work as an employee for a company, most companies today have things like 401k programs. So, Kim, let's talk about some of the things an individual can do, whether they're an employee or they're self-employed with regards to, let's say, a pension plan.
We have a lot of clients that are self-employed, or they might be W-2'd and they have a side business. There's a combination of situations. But for somebody who has their own business, they have many more opportunities to save taxes by using tax-deferred plans. I mean, the one that's probably most common for a self-employed sole proprietorship, and it could be a corporation too, but I'll just use a sole proprietorship as an example, is the SEP plan, the Simplified Employee Pension Plan. Many small business clients like to use that type of a tax-deferred plan because it doesn't need to be set up during the year. You can actually set it up as late as the due date of filing your tax returns, including extensions. If you're a Schedule C individual, algebraically it works out to a net 20% of your net Schedule C income that you can put into the SEP plan, and that's deducted above the line. It doesn't reduce your self-employment taxes, but it does reduce your income taxes, and it reduces your AGI, and it might help bring down the taxable income to get you out of some of these other insidious problems that you have. You know, the other option for self-employed sole proprietors that seems to be popular is the single owner 401k plan. I mean, if you have somebody who has no employees, instead of doing a SEP plan, they might be better off doing a single owner 401k plan because now not only can they put that company 20% portion in there, but they can also do an employee deferral portion of $17,500, maybe up to $23,000 if they're over 50. So the amount they can put into the retirement plan is much greater with a single owner 401k versus a SEP. Now, if you have employees, that changes the mix. If you have employees, you now have to include eligible employees in the plan, and you may have some concerns about the cost of doing that. But for folks that are self-employed, no employees, they have huge benefits to using a SEP, single owner 401k. And in some cases, I have a few clients that will use a defined benefit plan. This is a much more convoluted, it's a qualified plan that is going to require some administration fees to set it up and regulate it. But I can think of a handful of my clients, you know, they're making large six-figure incomes and they happen to be Schedule C's taxpayers and, you know, they're putting six-figure amounts into their defined benefit plan. So there's a number of options that can be used if you're self-employed. If you're not, again, if you're just W-2'd, it's tough. You have to do all this at the employer level.
Kim, what about investment income? And let's take this from two perspectives. Once again, the person that's an employee and then the person that is self-employed. Obviously, if I'm in these higher Obama tax rates where I'm losing my itemized deductions, my exemptions, I'm paying more Medicare tax, more income tax, wow, I am going to get walloped. You know, when you think of I could be paying, what, 24% with the Obamacare tax on capital gains and dividends, that's still cheaper in interest. Let's point that out too, Kim, because I think this is something investors miss. Let's take two forms of investment income. Interest income, like let's say earned on a bank CD, cash, or a taxable bond versus a dividend, because even though dividends have gone up and capital gains rates have gone up, they're still lower than the tax rate that interest is taxed at.
Yeah, I mean, interest is just taxed at ordinary rates, so whatever they are. So if you're in these higher levels, and let's just look at the federal rate, you're paying 39.6% on your interest, plus you're going to be paying this 3.8% on top of that for the net investment income, this new Medicare tax. So there's a double whammy with regard to that. Now, dividends are a little different, but if you have qualified dividends, which typically are from domestic companies, then you are subject to the lower rates, which used to be 15%. For those folks that aren't making these higher levels of income, they have the benefit of the 15% rate. But for folks that are in the higher brackets, there's still a lower rate on qualified dividend income of 20%. Now, the dividend income is still subject to that 3.8 tax on investment income, but you're paying a lower overall rate, almost 20% lower with qualified dividend income. So, you know, if you had to adjust the portfolio to save money and also try to get a decent return, I mean, you would know better than I, but, you know, interest rates are terrible. When I do tax returns now, I mean, in the old days, I used to see these 1099s for interest income with huge numbers. Now, it's a joke. People bring in these 1099s and there's hardly any interest income on huge amounts of money they have sitting in these CDs. So you have to really think about that and decide, well, with inflation, am I better off moving into something that generates a qualified dividend, which not only has a lower tax rate, but it might have a higher return versus the interest?
Let's talk about investments. Boy, I remember the good old days, Kim, in the 80s, where you saw this too as well, where you could go out and buy property, write off the depreciation of the property, shelter your income, and also use those deductions to offset your regular income. Now there's a limitation. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's $25,000. And also, doesn't that phase out over a certain level of income?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest disappointments. Clients, if they don't talk to me first and they go out and they're making decent money and they have a lot in the stock market and they figure, I want to diversify my portfolio and buy some real estate. Some of them don't talk to me in advance. And they go out and they buy some California rental property, which is, if they're lucky, it's break even, you know, depending on how much down payment. Well, with lower interest rates on the mortgages, it's not as bad as it used to be. But still, if they're lucky, it's break even. And then when you take depreciation, it's going to have this negative paper loss on it. So they're all excited and they come in to do their tax return. They tell me, hey, I got this write-off now on my rental property. And what you have to understand about rental property, in the old days, we date ourselves and go back to the 80s, this was not an issue. There were no limitations. But that all changed decades ago. And rental real estate, by default, is classified as a passive activity. And passive activity, losses on passive activities are limited. You can only really write off passive losses against passive income. Now, with real estate, there's a special exception to that that allows you to take up to $25,000 of your rental loss. However, there's a caveat to all that, which says that if your adjusted gross income exceeds $100,000 and goes up to $150,000, that $25,000 allowance of write-off that you typically get on the rental property phases out. So for somebody that's at $150,000 or more, and this is single, married, it doesn't really matter, they can't take any of their passive write-off. So they might have a rental property and it's thrown off a $15,000 write-off, and they come in and all of a sudden I need to tell them that, you know, your adjusted gross income is $200,000, which is not that uncommon. Most of our clients are in those levels. And so I have to explain the fact that, well, I got some good news and bad news. The bad news is you can't really take this as a write-off against your W-2 income, which you were hoping to do. The good news is you don't lose the loss. You suspend it. It carries forward indefinitely. And, you know, when you sell the property, it'll be freed up and can be offset against your W-2 income, anything. Or if you start generating some passive income on another rental property, or maybe you pay down the mortgage and you have a little bit more passive income, you can use that suspended loss against future net positive taxable income on the rental property. So you don't lose it, but it's not a valuable deduction in the year that you were hoping to take it. And so I've had that conversation with a number of clients and had to educate them on the limitations of real estate. So, I mean, real estate's a great investment. I'm not knocking it, but you have to, if you're going to diversify your portfolio and put money into real estate, you really have to think about it as a long-term appreciating asset and not look for a lot of short-term tax write-offs. Because you're not going to find them unless you're making under $100,000.
Kim, what about publicly traded partnerships or REITs that are traded on the stock exchange that can pass through some of the savings or deductions? In other words, the income or dividend you receive reduces your cost basis, but for taxable purposes, a good portion of the dividend is sheltered from taxation.
Well, you know, publicly traded partnerships, I'm not crazy about them from a tax perspective, just because a lot of clients purchase these or the brokers are buying and selling these things. And I think they may be getting some decent cash flow from them. I'm not quite sure. But there's a lot of complexities that go along with the accounting for these things, and people don't always understand it. Publicly traded partnerships are basically, they're limited partnerships that trade like stocks. And any losses that are generated, say, on a specific publicly traded partnership, that loss, it's not like a passive loss that can be offset against the income or the passive income from another publicly traded partnership. So the activity for each of these publicly traded partnerships is segregated. So what happens is if you have a loss in a publicly traded partnership, it's subject to the passive loss rules. First of all, it's not going to pass through and offset anything else. And it can only really be used against income from that publicly traded partnership or freed up when it's sold. The biggest complexity we run into with these things is that if people buy a lot of them, their accounting bill typically goes up and they start complaining and don't understand why, because the input and the analysis that we have to go through to put this information into their tax return, particularly if they're oil and gas partnerships, there's more issues with those, takes more time. And then if you're buying and selling these things, you have this whole basis issue that changes. When you go out and you buy a publicly traded partnership, it looks like you just purchased, you know, a stock on the portfolio, and the brokerage statements will actually show the cost basis of that on the statement when it's sold, like they typically do for stocks. But that cost basis is incorrect. It has to be recalculated based on the income and losses or distributions that came out of that publicly traded partnership. So we have to do a lot of extra work on these things. And from an investment standpoint, they might be a good deal. You may know better than I do. But from an accounting standpoint, I'm constantly having to defend my fees for the extra time it takes us to account for these things. And they're not really an investment to generate any write-offs. They're really, in most cases, I think they're used to generate a little more cash flow compared to maybe some of the other alternatives that are out there.
Let's talk about something that is a gotcha for a lot of middle-class taxpayers, and that's something called the alternative minimum tax. So let's say, Kim, you're still in the Bush tax era brackets. Let's say you're below 200, single, 250, married, so you're not losing your itemized deductions or the phase out of your exemptions. But let's suppose that you have, let's say you're single, you're making 150, 160,000, or you're married between husband and wife, you're making 200,000, but you have things like property taxes, state income taxes, especially in a high tax state like California. You have charitable deductions. If you have too many of them, the government can say, well, you have too much of that. We're going to apply a different tax rate towards your income. Let's talk about the alternative minimum tax, which was designed to make sure that people that were very wealthy couldn't shelter all their income. It was aimed at the wealthy, but now it's coming back to bite the middle class.
Yeah, this is probably the least understood aspect of a tax return for most people. Because with alternative minimum tax, there's really limited planning that you can do for it. I mean, you can plan not to take certain deductions in advance if they're not going to benefit you. But the alternative minimum tax is kind of an insidious secondary calculation that's done on everybody's tax return in the background that nobody really talks about or sees except the accountant. And it recalculates the income, basically, in most cases, by disallowing certain deductions like real estate taxes and state income taxes and personal property taxes. Miscellaneous itemized deductions. These things are not deducted for all men. Even if you're investing in municipal bonds and you have interest that's considered private activity bonds or some muni interest that's not exempt for alternative minimum tax, that's added back, so you kind of lose the benefit of the municipal bond income if you're not careful. And so what happens is you do an alternative calculation on the return and you take the larger of the alternative minimum tax or the regular tax. And what's happened over the years is more and more people, like you said just a minute ago, in high tax states with high real estate taxes and high state income taxes. And you'll find, you know, the average person that's not necessarily making $400,000 or more is subject to alternative minimum tax. And, you know, clients are always asking, well, what can I do about this? And it's tough to really regulate. There's not really a lot we can do about it except just plan for it and be careful about getting into private activity bonds if there's a municipal bond portfolio. Not necessarily telling the client to prepay their state or their real estate taxes early if it's not going to do them any good. You know, there's a number of preferences that are involved, but the most common ones are the real estate taxes and the state income tax. Those seem to be the elements that push most people, you know, into this all men situation.
Kim, as we sum up here, if we take two categories of individuals, one individual is an employee, works for a company, two things that they need to know. Number one, based on their income, they could be losing some of their itemized deductions and exemptions. So they need to be made aware of that so they don't have that gotcha tax when they come in to see someone like yourself to file their tax return. Secondly, their probably best defense that they can use is any available pension plan they have at work, whether it's a 401k or any kind of plan where you take that income off your gross income and can shelter it. So you avoid the tax. In many cases, the employer matches it. Another one is if you are going to have investment income, with interest rates near zero, inflation at about 1.6%, and the taxation of interest is twice what it is on dividends, you may be better off in dividend income. Now, for a self-employed individual, I guess maybe they have a few more options because there's a lot more things they can write off. They have a lot more alternatives when it comes to sheltering their income with pensions. But outside of that, haven't you found that over the years, they have become more restrictive in terms of what you're allowed to do to shelter your income, unless, you know, maybe you're a Hollywood mogul with connections to the White House?
Yeah, I think over the years it has done. But if you're smart and you do some planning, you can at least minimize it. I mean, I'm amazed that people will come in here, you know, the W-2 earners, and they'll say, what can I do to save taxes? And I'll look at their W-2, and I'll say, well, you have a 401k plan here. You only put $3,000 into it. You know, why didn't you max it out? That's a huge benefit if you would do that. And if you're seeing them during tax season, it's too late to go back and do anything, you hope. So I'm always encouraging people to fund these qualified plans through their employer. Maybe use a health savings account if they're eligible, if they have the right type of insurance for that. And for the self-employed people, there's just more opportunities, not only with retirement plans, 401k plans, single owner 401k, steps, defined benefit plans, all of that. But with a self-employed person or a S-corp or a small business, you have other things you can legally write off in the business. Many times you're using your car for business use, and you might be able to take a portion of that. If you're working out of your home, you may be able to get a home office deduction, which is sometimes overrated, but there's some small benefits that you can get in those areas as well. The employee, again, if he's incurring expenses for his employer, he really needs to talk to the employer about setting up some kind of an accountable plan where he gets reimbursed for them. Way better than him trying to deduct these on his tax return because of the severe limitations. So, yeah, I mean, it has gotten more difficult. When I first got into the business, people were buying tax shelters and getting 3-to-1 write-offs, and it was a game.
Yeah, I remember that. I used to do that. I used to get together in December and figure out what my taxes were, and I'd buy a 3-to-1 tax shelter and eliminate them. And it wasn't the tax reform with Ronald Reagan I actually started paying income taxes.
Yeah. Now, you really need to do planning, whether you're self-employed or you're a wage earner. It's worth your while to do a little bit of tax planning with your tax professional. Even if it only boils down to knowing exactly what things are going to look like, even if you have minimal things you can do about it, it's still better than the shock factor of coming in and finding out you owe $30,000 on April 15th. So we try to avoid that like the plague, but it takes cooperation with clients.
Well said. Well, listen, Kim, I want to thank you for coming on the program and sharing some of those facts, because I know that we've gotten some emails. I wanted to do a show on this with a lot of our listeners who have been shocked at what happened to them when they filed their 2013 tax returns, because the bill was passed at 3 a.m. on January 1st of 2013. And everybody knew about the tax rates of $400,000, $450,000, but they didn't know about all the different nuances of itemized deductions, exemptions, the taxation of interest, dividends, capital gains, Medicare tax. There were so many things in that law that the media did not inform investors and taxpayers, and I appreciate you sharing that with our listeners. So thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure, Jim. Talk to you soon.
Well, that concludes my interview with Kim Fischera. He's my own personal tax accountant, and I've worked closely with him over the years. And as he brought up, one of the most important things you can do is do some planning. You know, lifetime income is all about planning for retirement. And obviously, if you can save more taxes, save your investments on a tax-deferred basis, the larger nest egg you're going to have when you retire. Why pay unnecessarily extra taxes if you don't have to? And like anything else, the greater success you're going to enjoy in meeting your retirement goals is going to depend on the type of plan you put in place, whether it's your investments, your taxes. Having a plan is like having a map when you're taking a trip. You never leave your house to go take a trip without, let's say, a GPS in your car or at least a roadmap to know where you're going to go. It's the same with your retirement plan, and part of it is minimizing taxes. The more that you save on taxes, those are more dollars in your pocketbook that are earning interest or dividends and growing and compounding to make your retirement more secure. Well, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.